Well, thanks for coming along. And, well, seems like an appropriate time to start talking about the horrors of hell when it's warm like this. Oh, we'll endure, won't we? It'll be all right. We'll get through it. You can have yourself, we wouldn't have a lifeguard, otherwise you could have a swim. All right? But, what a privilege it has been for us to be with you. So thank you so much for your welcome and your kindness to us, and to me in particular. And crew, you in the building? Thank you. Thank you on behalf of all of us. And they even asked us to dine with them this evening. So wonderful time to see young people serving. And thank you for your service to all of us in that way. Just one other reminder, and that is I'm asking that if you would take some moments in the next 24 hours to think about a testimony about the faithfulness of God, that would be appreciated. We will have some of you share those in some fashion, and so you can be thinking about a testimony of faithfulness, and we'll interact about that tomorrow. For those of you that have come to join us for the evening of Wednesday, we are working our way through the Psalms of Asaph, more or less backwards, and doing that as a reminder to you that I come from the bottom side of the world. And we're enjoying the time as we work our way through them, but decided we should mess that up a little bit and throw a curve, and so we are in Psalm 74, Psalm 74 this evening. And it's been commented that it's helpful sometimes to see how in the world we come to our outlines of a text. And so I've endeavored to show you that a couple of times, and I'll do that again this evening. And then we will jump in and investigate the text. We have 5 points this evening. We should be out of here by the time it's cool. So 5 points. If you look at your text in Psalm 74, you notice that it begins, "O God," this is a congregation's cry, the congregation's cry. And then if you go down to verse number 4, what we found in verses 1 through 3 was all of these requests towards God. Why does your anger smoke? Remember your congregation, and so forth. In verse 3, he talks, "Turn your footsteps toward the perpetual ruins." Here in verse 4, he begins a different focus. It's the adversary's actions, because he talks about what's happened. He says, "Your adversaries have roared." And then you find verse 4, the second half says, "They have set up their own standards." And then he carries on, verse 6, "They smashed." Verse 7, "They have burned." Verse 7 again, "They have defiled." Verse 8, "They said, and they have burned." So verses 4 to 8 are the adversary's acts. You can see from the pronoun used that it's primarily focused on what's happened to the nation. Then we come to verse 9, where we have the prophet's absence. The prophet's absence. "We do not see our signs." There is no longer any prophet. And he carries on through verse 11. Then in verse 12, we find another transition where he says, "Yet God is my king of old." Notice verse 13, he says, "You divided, you broke, you crushed, you gave, you broke, you dried up. Yours is the day, yours also is the night. You have prepared the light and the sun. You have established all the boundaries of the earth. You have made the sun and winter." Clearly, he's referring back to his God and recognizing the acts of God. So verses 12 to 17 are the Lord's acts. A-C-T-S, in case some of you have already read ahead and thought maybe I was referring to something else. Finally, the afflicted's request. The afflicted's request in verses 18 to 23. You see, he goes from speaking of all the things the Lord had done to saying, remember this. And do not deliver, verse 19. And do not forget, in verse 20, consider. In verse 21, let not, let the afflicted. And then he says, arise, remember, do not forget. So what we find is the request of the afflicted. There you have it. The congregation's cry, the adversary's acts, the prophet's absence, the Lord's acts, the afflicted's request. If you like Cliff Notes, you can go home. 200 years ago in New Zealand, I mentioned the other day that missionaries began to arrive. And in fact, it is just about around this date, specifically, the first gospel preached in New Zealand happened 200 years ago. And as missionaries began to arrive, they began to face opposition, as you might expect. We spoke a little bit about that the other day. The Maori, our native folks in the land, didn't understand what this white man was here for. Didn't understand that it was a gospel of peace. The Maori thought, that these men were just like all the other white men who had come, who were whalers, who were sailors, who would stop on their way somewhere, and perhaps because they've been in the area whaling, they would stop. And those men were not the kinds of good repute. They would trade with the Maori. They would abuse the Maori. They would take advantage of the Maori. And so the Maori came to these missionaries as they had come and began to try to treat them as they had been treated, not knowing of a difference. And the opposition continued with those early missionaries, being viewed even as aiding some illegal immigration into New Zealand. What happened was there were, again, some of those unscrupulous men in England who had heard of the landmass in New Zealand, which is about the same landmass as California, and decided, well, this is a good opportunity for business. We'll sell the land. And so they would sell parcels of land to other English and then get them on a boat and send them to New Zealand. Problem? It's a bit like selling stars today. Nobody had been there and told the Maori, this is somebody else's land now. Well, that didn't go over so well as you might expect. But that early leading missionary's name was Henry Williams. Henry Williams tried to aid the situation and bring some resolution to the opposition that was rising between the Maori and primarily the English. And so they had come to an arrangement. It's called the Treaty of Waitangi. And the Treaty of Waitangi is a bit like our Declaration of Independence. The Treaty of Waitangi, Henry Williams encouraged the Maori to sign, because what it would do would be to protect the Maori's rights while the Maori would make an arrangement, an agreement with the Westerners regarding the use of the land. That was just a conflict that arose out of people desiring to take the gospel to another land. We face other oppositions today. In New Zealand, we still, by God's grace, have prayer before the beginning of every parliament session. But as you might imagine, there are those that are not in favor of that, and so they oppose that and are coming up against that, trying to get it stopped. As a church, Riverbend Bible Church and the Shepherd's Bible College faces opposition. We face opposition because we're too narrow. We define doctrine. And that is not appreciated in the postmodern culture of New Zealand, where everybody believes that whatever I think the text says is what it says. They come across us and they say, how narrow can you be? To believe the doctrines of grace, to believe in salvation by grace through faith alone, and believe in separation from the world unto holiness. They think we're narrow, too dogmatic. In fact, I had a friend that I went to New Zealand with way back in 89. He stayed. He married a Kiwi. And when I told him that I was looking at joining this ministry that I'm a part of, he said, "You are going to join those crazies?" Just to give you a sense of where people are in the country. Such a clarity in terms of what the scriptures actually say, and being willing to proclaim it causes opposition. Not something that you are unfamiliar with. As you know, I've had the privilege of being associated with Grace Community Church through the years, and through those years there has been opposition to John MacArthur, to the message of the pulpit of Grace Community Church. There's regularly people out on the sidewalk trying to tell the attenders of Grace Community that they're crazy, they're wrong, they're too narrow, or they're not narrow enough sometimes. And had the privilege of interacting with some of them over the years. I don't know if you noted, some of the young people probably have, that just this last week on Sunday, there was a man who decided to rise up the stairs towards the pulpit as John was beginning the evening service, I think it was, and began to proclaim to the congregation that John and the doctrine of Grace Community Church are out of line. He was a prophet. And he felt that people needed to know that the sign gifts are for today, and he was there to tell them. Opposition. Well, all of that opposition that I've described is relatively tame compared to the opposition that we find in our psalm this evening in Psalm 74. The people of God were in a very precarious time and situation. If you notice, verse 7 says, "They have burned your sanctuary to the ground." Now that's opposition. Some of our brethren around the world suffer the same sort of opposition today. But you and I have been privileged to live in a place where we don't regularly have our churches burnt. That's what the people were facing in Psalm 74. So what we'll do this evening as we investigate Psalm 74 is come to see how the opposed people of God handled the conflict. We hope to learn from that how to not fall prey to the pitfall of opposition so that we can continue in our life of unhindered worship. God has to be sought when opposition comes. Let's read it together. "O God, why have you rejected us forever? Why does your anger smoke against the sheep of your pasture? Remember your congregation which you have purchased of old, which you have redeemed to be the tribe of your inheritance, and this Mount Zion where you have dwelt. Turn your footsteps toward the perpetual ruins. The enemy has damaged everything within the sanctuary. Your adversaries have roared in the midst of your meeting place. They have set up their own standards for signs. It seems as if one had lifted up his axe in a forest of trees. And now all its carved work they smash with hatchet and the hammers. They have burned your sanctuary to the ground. They have defiled the dwelling place of your name. They said in their heart, 'Let us completely subdue them.' They have burned all the meeting places of God in the land. We do not see our signs. There is no longer any prophet, nor is there any among us who knows how long. How long, O God, will the adversary revile and the enemy spurn your name forever? Why do you withdraw your hand, even your right hand? From within your bosom, destroy them. Yet God is my king from of old, who works deeds of deliverance in the midst of the earth. You divided the sea by your strength. You broke the heads of the sea monsters in the waters. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. You broke open springs and torrents. You dried up ever-flowing streams. Yours is the day. Yours also is the night. You have prepared the light and the sun. You have established all the boundaries of the earth. You have made summer and winter. Remember this, O Lord, that the enemy has reviled and a foolish people has spurned your name. Do not deliver the soul of your turtle dove to the wild beast. Do not forget the life of your afflicted forever. Consider the covenant, for the dark places of the land are full of the habitations of violence. Let not the oppressed return dishonored. Let the afflicted and needy praise your name. Arise, O God, plead your own cause. Remember how the foolish man reproaches you all day long. Do not forget the voice of your adversaries, the uproar of those who rise against you, which ascends continually. The congregation's cry is where we begin. In verses 1 to 3, we found there two questions. Two questions in verse 1 and two requests in verses 2 and 3. The questions were, why are you allowing this? Or worse yet, why are you doing this? Why is the situation such that your anger smokes against the sheep of your pasture? That's his question. This is the congregation's cry. Asaph is raising this on behalf of the congregation in a desperate situation. And we believe that the timing, I believe anyway, is along with a number of others, that we're reading of a time in which there was great devastation within the land. The people were still within the land, but there obviously had been great opposition that they faced. And there would be just like us. Just like us, at a time of opposition, what do? Why? Why me? Why this? Why are you doing this to me? And so the request follows out of the questions. We'll find answers as we go. But just quickly to get through at least the beginning of this, the requests are, remember and turn. Verse 2, remember your congregation. These are your people, God. These are the ones you had purchased. These are the ones you'd redeemed. These are the ones you delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians and brought into the land. Remember them. This place where you dwell on earth. And secondly, he then asks God to turn. He puts those anthropomorphic sense onto God, asking God, as it were, to go from wherever it is he is going, because the people of God are feeling as though God is headed the other direction. And he asks that God would turn toward the perpetual ruins. It gives us a sense that this was something that wasn't new. It was something that seemed to have happened time and again. The enemy had damaged everything within the sanctuary. Imagine the congregation just seeing the devastation. What do? And yet we even have recent examples in our own country. People who, part of a church in Charleston, who had a man come in and open fire on the congregation. Imagine that. Imagine how you would feel. Imagine what your questions would be. Fellow missionary and man that I had the privilege of working with at Grace Community before he went to the mission field grew up in South Africa. And you may know that back in the early 90s, there was a man that came into St. James Church in Cape Town, South Africa, and opened fire. And he killed some 20 people, injured dozens of people. Why? Wanted to oppose the people of God. What does this man do in Charleston? He wanted to cause a stir. Wanted to go up against those that would be an easy target. Opposition. You know, like I do, when we hear of these things in our day and in our time, we say, why? We call out and we look for God to step in, wondering why this is occurring. In our psalm, we find a people who have experienced devastation, great opposition to themselves, and they begin with a cry to their God. So appropriate. You and I would do the same thing. We then find in verses 4 to 8 some of the acts of those adversaries, some of the things that have happened. There's seven acts affecting the worship of Israel. Seven of them in verses 4 to 8. Your adversaries have roared in the midst of your meeting place. They've come in like a lion, right into the meeting place of God. Certainly, the enemies of God are not to be in the meeting place. We know our Old Testament well enough to know that is not supposed to happen. It is very particular who can even go in to the tabernacle. But the enemy came in roaring like a lion. They set up their own standards for signs. I've come to learn that a standard is like a main post. It guides the building. It guides the direction and the path by which you will build the rest of the fence line. They had set up their own standards for signposts. This was them coming in and saying, here's how you should worship. It seemed to them, and I know if you have your King James with you this evening, the translation between the New American Standard and the King James on verse 5 is quite different. And King James says, a man was famous according as he had lifted up axes upon the thick trees. New American Standard translation is, I think, well said. It's not that either of them necessarily head down a different track. It's a matter of understanding where that's intended to be. I think this says it well. It was as though someone went and was able to be lifted up and cut down the forest. What happens when that happens? You have it happening down the road. You come by the deforested part of the highway and you see that it's cleared out. That's the point. They had come in roaring like a lion, and it was just like they had lifted up the axe in the forest. They had destroyed everything. In fact, verse 6, all the carved work within the tabernacle had been smashed with a hatchet and hammers. They'd burned your sanctuary to the ground. They've defiled the dwelling place of your name. And what did they do? As they set up their standard, it's reinforced here, verse 8. They said in their heart, let us completely subdue them. The enemy of God says, no God will be able to stand against our God. In Old Testament times, that was the way you went about it. And you can read of that as you read your Old Testament. You're familiar with some of those stories. The foreign nations come against the people of God, and they think that their God is going to stand for them and not be able or be able to conquer Israel's God. This was the common practice of the ancient people. They would believe that the strength was found in their God, and so they would go and attack the enemy's God or what stood for their enemy's God. And in the case of Israel, Israel's God was represented by the tabernacle, later by the temple. It was the place of worship. And you and I know that while the Old Testament describes the Ark of the Covenant as a particularly special dwelling place of God on earth, God cannot be contained. Enemies thought he could. They came in thinking that if we burn their meeting place down, their God is defeated, and if their God's defeated, the people are defeated. 1 Kings chapter 18. Here's what happens when enemies of God think that they can stand against God. You're familiar with the story. It's the story of Elijah coming up against the prophets of Baal. 1 Kings chapter 18, we pick up the story in verse 17. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is this you, you troubler of Israel?" Remember, Ahab is the reigning king of the time. He is the leader of God's chosen nation. So wicked is he that he sees God's prophet as the troubler of Israel. And so he says that to him as Elijah comes to present himself to Ahab at Ahab's request. Verse 18, he said, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, because you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and you have followed the Baals. Now then, send and gather to me all Israel at Mount Carmel, together with 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah, who eat at Jezebel's table." You remember well, the story unfolds. We have the prophets of Baal given the opportunity to show the strength of their God. They lay out the offering, and they are to call on their God and to have their God consume that offering, that sacrifice. Round about noon, verse 27, Elijah mocked them and said, "Call out with a loud voice, for he is a god. Either he's occupied or gone aside or is on a journey. Perhaps he's asleep, needs to be awakened." So, the latter part of the day comes. In verse 36, after they have put the offering upon the altar, they have covered it with water, made sure it's drenched. At the time of the evening offering, verse 36, of the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet came near and said, "O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel, that I am your servant and I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord. Answer me that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God and that you have turned their heart back again." And you know what happens. Fire consumes the offering. And when all the people, verse 39, saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." Because God is the one who can do the miraculous. See, what happened when the situation came was God showed Himself to be God. In our Psalm, Psalm 74, we find the people languishing because God didn't do the miraculous, but allowed the enemy to burn down their meeting place. And so they've cried out to God, and they are recounting the acts of the enemies because they're questioning why. The enemy thinks that they've conquered Israel. They think that somehow God has been defeated because they've been able to burn down the meeting place. And the people are left to wonder, what's the story? How long is this going to be like this? We don't know what's going to happen. Verse 9, "We do not see our signs. There's no longer any prophet. nor is there any among us who knows how long. We might just have to go the rest of our days like this. An enemy thinking they've defeated us, able to come in and burn whatever we build. We just don't know what's going to happen. You notice the repetition of the idea of the signs there from earlier on. The enemy had set up their standards as signs. And here he says, we don't even see our signs. We just don't have a direction here. How long, verse 10, will the adversary revile and the enemy spurn your name? Forever? Why do you withdraw your hand? You understand that. You understand a people crying out in the midst of a disastrous situation. They've been opposed by an enemy who has been able to do unbelievable things to the people of God. I wonder, will you look over at Proverbs chapter 1 with me? In Proverbs chapter 1, we're familiar with Proverbs. It lays out the wise way of living and the wise way of life. It gives us those proverbs for life. And the reason I'm going here now is because the people in the situation in Psalm 74 were wondering. We don't see any wisdom here. We don't see any signs. We don't know what's going to happen. And the same sort of thing can come out of our lips. Notice verse 20. Wisdom shouts in the street. She lifts her voice in the square. At the head of the noisy street, she cries out at the entrance of the gates in the city. She utters her sayings. How long, O naive ones, will you love being simple-minded? And scoffers delight themselves in scoffing, and fools hate knowledge. Turn to my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit on you. I will make my words known to you. This is written to the same people, Israel, God's people, in Psalm 74. Could have called out for wisdom, but they hadn't. Now they find themselves defeated, and they're wondering why. The application for you and me is, do you seek God's wisdom now? That you will know God's work, God's ways, that when you are opposed, you will know the wise path to follow? You see, I think that the people of God could have had wisdom from God to know if we continue to live in sin, God is going to do something. Because God had promised His protection of His people if they had trusted and obeyed. But they weren't protected because they weren't trusting and obeying. They weren't seeking the wisdom that cries out and makes itself available to man. Proverbs 1 goes on to say, because I called and you refused, I stretched out my hand and no one paid attention, and you neglected all my counsel and did not want my reproof. I will also laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your dread comes. When your dread comes like a storm and your calamity comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you, then you will call on me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me because they hated knowledge. They did not choose the fear of the Lord. Disobedience has consequences. God's people were called to be an obedient people, and they weren't. And their disobedience had consequences, and now they're calling out to their God. So we've seen these things as they desire to know what's happening and the adversary's acts and the prophet's absence, and so we come to see now the Lord's acts. It's an interesting change of perspective. It's dramatic. It's a huge shift from why to yet or but. But God is my King from of old. The psalmist, in recalling all that has happened to the nation, is able to take a step back and say, yet my God is King. He's King from of old, who works deeds of deliverance in the midst of the earth. And we find following from that nine acts in nature that are all delivering acts. Nine of them. Notice it. Verse 13. You divided the sea by your strength. You broke the heads of the sea monsters in the waters. God delivered by providing a division of the sea in His strength. God delivered by breaking the heads of the sea monsters. God delivered by crushing the heads of Leviathan and gave it as food for the creatures of the wilderness. Verse 15, God delivered by breaking open springs and torrents. God delivered by drying up ever-flowing streams so His people could enter the land. You see, here you find these acts of God in deliverance through the acts of nature. Things in which He would step in and deliver His people because of His great goodness to His people. And so what we find ourselves in is a situation in which God's people have spurned their God. They've carried on with their own sinfulness, and yet now they're wondering why this has happened. We are all well. So we will continue. And as they wonder, why has this happened to us, they need to recognize their sinfulness that has brought about such actions by their God. But what the prophet does is to take a step back and to recognize, my God is the King. My God has acted in acts of nature to deliver His people before. What's the conclusion to be drawn? So He could do it again, if He chose to do so. Verse 12 set up this section. It was the transition from all of those acts of the enemy to now look at the acts of our God. He's a delivering God, and He can choose to do so again if He chooses. God has always worked for the deliverance of those He chooses to deliver. It says He, verse 17, had established all the boundaries of the earth and even made summer and winter, which at times have been a means of deliverance of His people. So you come then, obviously, to the afflicted's request. Having this be the singer of Israel, the man standing to proclaim the situation before the people, he first cries out to God, recognizes the acts of the enemy, wonders about their own prophet's absence, then looks at the Lord's acts in nature and in deliverance before, which would obviously lead to the request for deliverance now. It's the afflicted's request. It's verses 18 to 23. Remember this, O Lord. Remember what? He's just recounted the great deliverance of God, as though as a reminder. But now, remember that the enemy has reviled. A foolish people has spurned your name. We find that there's 10 requests here of the psalmist asking God to remember, to consider. It's the afflicted's request, and there's 10 of them in verses 18 through 23. Remember this, that the enemy is reviled, a foolish people has spurned your name. Do not deliver the soul of your turtle dove to the wild beast, and do not forget the life of your afflicted forever. Two more of them in verse 19 there. Isn't that a great picture? Think about it. The turtle dove and the beast, the wild beast. The turtle dove, that most innocent, incapable, most precious. And we say that in New Zealand. If you are one who is fragile, you're precious. That turtle dove, precious as it is, the request is, don't turn it over to the wild beast. The wild beast that can, wham, it's done. Right? It's all over. No hope for the turtle dove. That's a great picture for the people of God to remember. That I'm just a turtle dove. I'm precious. I have no strength, no ability, no chance of delivering myself from the wiles of the enemy. But my God has all strength and all ability to care for me and to deliver me. Carries on in verse 20. Consider the covenant. And really, this gets to the heart of it. He's asking these various things. Remember this. Don't do this. Don't forget that. But at the end of the day, the only thing God's people had to go on at this point was a covenant. That God had covenanted saying, this is my people. And they would be his people. And so the covenant becomes a critical aspect for the people who have lost their way to be able to request their God to act in their current situation. They say, consider the covenant. Why? Because the dark places of the land are full of the habitations of violence. Everything around them had become filled with enemies. And a potential of violence and the potential of their precious selves being delivered over to those who could quickly dispose of them. So don't let the oppressed return dishonored. God, remember your covenant so that those who are oppressed, your children who have gone through this opposition and have seen their meeting place burned to the ground. Don't let them return dishonored. Don't let the afflicted and needy, just let them praise your name. You see the heart of the psalmist? Similar to the heart of Moses. A heart in which time after time the people would walk in disobedience and not trust their God, and yet Moses would find himself on his knees praying on their behalf. There's a sense here in which Asaph is similar. These people have spurned the name of God. They have gone their own way, but yet they're your covenant people, God. Would you let them praise you again? When you come to that, you then have what you can ask. Arise, O God, plead your own cause. Don't plead our cause because our cause is hopeless. Plead your own. It's about God. It's about His glory. It's about His honor. It's about the covenant that He had made with His people. And the psalmist knows that he needs to ask God to rise for His own cause. And only remember how the foolish man reproaches the God of the universe all day long. So how could our God allow them to continue and allow the uproar of those who rise against God to continually ascend? That's the request. certainly, God, you cannot allow that to continue. And so we plead all that we can, which is the good work that you promised. Nothing of ourselves deserves it. Simply that God had chosen to work with this people. Isn't the application rather obvious? God has chosen those who have come into faith in Jesus Christ as a chosen nation today. Those he has saved by grace through faith alone stand in a position in which God has chosen to save them, make them a special people, and carry them through the rest of their days and bring them to their eternal glory. So how do we handle opposition? If we're going to avoid falling prey to the pitfall of opposition, we need to be a little bit different than the Israelites of the day. We need to be able to come into those situations in which we are opposed and handle them rightly. And I think Paul, as you probably would agree, does the best job of explaining that for us, of showing us in his own life example how he stood to the opposition of those that were not for God. The man who would choose to be about the business of destroying this young thing, this young sect called Christianity, would be saved by the glorious grace of God, would become the proclaimer of that gospel to the Gentile world, would suffer tremendous opposition. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. He brings us to hear, or 2 Corinthians chapter 11, to hear a little bit about some of that opposition and what he had to suffer. And he says in chapter 11, beginning in verse 21, "To my shame, I must say that we have been weak by comparison." You understand what he's doing with the Corinthians, right? He's entering into a little folly with them. He didn't want to have to defend his apostleship, but because the Corinthians continued to push and say, "This man is of no account. I mean, he stammers, he stutters, he's ugly. I mean, what is he?" He writes pretty strong letters, but he's pretty weak. So he has to get to the place of defending his apostleship. And so he says in verse 21, second half, "Whatever respect anyone else is bold, I speak in foolishness. I'm just as bold myself. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I speak as if insane. I more so," insane because he's entering into this folly, "I more so in far more labors, far more imprisonments, beaten times without number, often in danger of death." Just take through verse 23. That's serious opposition. You've been imprisoned, a lot of labor, beaten, in danger of death. Verse 24, "Five times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have spent in the deep. Been on frequent journeys and dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the cities, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren." This is an opposed man. Lots of opposition. "I've been in labor, hardship, through many sleepless nights, hunger, thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure." God forbid we go a day without food. This man had to suffer this regularly for the sake of the gospel. Apart from such external things, There's a daily pressure on me of concern for all the churches. Those external things. You know, those lashings, those stonings, being out in the middle of the ocean, shipwrecked. Those are just external things. You know what can be really concerning? Trying to shepherd people. That's what Paul's saying. This intense concern. He says, verse 29, who's weak without my being weak? Who's led into sin without my intense concern? If I have to boast, I'll boast of what pertains to my weakness. The God and Father of our Lord Jesus, He who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying. Look over at chapter 12, verse 7. Because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me, to keep me from exalting myself. And concerning this, I implored the Lord 3 times that it might leave me. And He said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Here's the point. Look at it, verse 9, second half. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. So I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. Because when I'm weak, then I am strong. Father, may we consider deeply, consider well your cause. What a glory, what an unbelievable position to be a child of God. You fill our hearts with joy at the very thought that we have an eternity with our Maker because of the glorious work of Jesus Christ. But it's more. For you call us to be about your business. You give us a cause in this life. You call us to stand for you, to proclaim you, to live for you. And as we do, we know there are those that will oppose us. And Father, make us weak, that we might be strong in you, that we might bring greater glory to you, that we might recognize that deliverance is by your hand and by your goodness. And we say thank you that we already have the promise that you will care for us, that you will lead us and guide us, and that you will bring us into our eternal reward. And we say thank you in Christ's name. Amen.